I refuse to testify on the grounds that my organs will be chopped up into a patty.
Ah, the 67th Amendment.
For a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
Can you see Captain Blackadder anywhere in this courtroom?
That's him! That's him! That's the man!
Ah! No more questions, sir.
Or you'll be held in contempt of this court.
I have nothing but contempt for this court.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 100 of the Opening Arguments podcast. How are you doing, Andrew Torres?
I am great, Thomas. I am super excited that we're here on episode number 100. Thanks to everybody who listens, everybody who supports us, everybody who supports us on Patreon. This is great. I never thought I would do 100 episodes of a podcast, and now I can't imagine not doing this show.
Yeah, well, let's get through this one first before, you know, who knows, maybe.
Yeah, right. I've done 99.1 episodes of a podcast already.
So. We might finally get struck down by a lightning bolt or something before finishing this one. No.
We have been taunting the God of Thunder quite a bit on this show. So
excited to be back. You had it. How was your vacation? You have a good little trip?
Yeah, it was fantastic. I really liked the shows that we put out. Put in the Can had while you were giving birth to little, well, not you personally, but while Lydia was giving birth to Opening Arguments Smith, and I trust she's in good health.
Oh, she's doing great. She's a tiny baby. She's almost the size of a baby now. Like almost the size of a newborn now. It's kind of, I don't know why she's so small, but she's like 6 pounds and it's been 2 weeks.
I was a little tiny baby too, so, you know.
Well, there you go. She's in good company. Well, with that said, I'm glad you got a little time off there, but I'm also glad to be back for the newsworthy Friday show because there is so much to do here. We're going to talk about...
I was hoping Donald Trump might give us a couple weeks off, but I guess that's not going to happen.
It will never happen. It will never happen. First off, though, up for today, we've got an extended Andrew Was Wrong segment. Just everything. It's good to wait till after your vacation, and then we like piled up the things you were wrong about, and then we're going to have to give them to you all at once. So welcome back with that. And then we're going to talk about, of course, the trans-military ban. There's some interesting questions going on there. I heard that Mattis wasn't going to go through with it, but that might be a bit of fake news. We'll see. And then we're going to talk about the Arpaio pardon, which I talked about Arpaio a little bit on my show, but I tried to leave all the best legal stuff. I didn't, meaning I didn't bother trying to do it because I knew you would do a way better job. So we're going to find out if it's legal. A lot of people have said this means he can no longer invoke the Fifth Amendment and he admits guilt for civil lawsuits. All those questions that people have, that'll be in the C segment. So with all that said, I'm excited. Let's get to it.
Me too.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
I discovered at a very early age that if I talk long enough, I could make anything right or wrong. So either I'm God or truth is relative. And in either case, booyah.
Oh, interesting. It's just the average person has a much harder time saying booyah to moral relativism.
All right. Andrew, you were wrong. A lot.
Yeah, I was wrong about a number of things. I would like to say we've compiled these up over a really lengthy period of time, but it's really been like a week and a half. So so here are the things that I was wrong about in no particular order. First, our friends over at Northpod Law UK, the Opening Arguments of Britain, sent us a note when I was riffing about 80s softcore porn actress and pop singer Samantha Fox. I said she was a Page Six girl, and apparently in the UK, the tabloid, that the proper phraseology there and the proper page number is she was a page three girl. Hmm. Kristen also added that she appeared in the 16-bit program Strip Poker for the Atari ST. which is a computer which was marginally popular here in the States and somewhat more popular in Europe. I'm a big Atari aficionado. I'm a big Samantha Fox aficionado. So I am just mortified to have missed all of those connections. So I appreciate that. Those corrections about Samantha Fox.
All right. Well, surely that's all, right? Are you done? That's the only thing.
Our good friend, Aaron Rabinowitz, friend of the show and host of the Embracing the Void podcast, which you and I have both been on, corrected a statement that was sort of ambiguous that Donald Trump wrote Donald Trump Jr.'s response to the media regarding his meeting with the Russians. The official position of the Trump White House is that Donald Trump is that they've taken no position on whether Donald Trump Jr. met with the Russians at all. So and we were trying to say that, but Aaron was sort of pointing out that there was a pronoun antecedent that was left ambiguous that made it sound like Trump wrote Jr.'s response to the Russians themselves, which is, you know, not correct. So appreciate that friendly correction. And now we're still not done. I'm sorry.
We're like a fifth of the way done. No, not really.
Yeah. Matthew Foltz wrote in to tell us that the University of Texas is referred to as UT and not UT Austin. And also that the Texas legislature passed an exception to the top 10% rule, making it just the top 7% rule for admission to the University of Texas. And I appreciate both of those corrections. I will point out that this is much more appropriately directed to our forthcoming segment, The Supreme Court Got It Wrong, because I was reading from, this came up in our discussion of affirmative action and the landmark Texas cases. I was reading from the facts section of the Supreme Court opinion. So the Supreme Court, it's even in the heading as University of Texas.
Yeah, so direct your letters to the Supreme Court there, everybody. Yeah.
So Matthew, I appreciate it, but send your correction in. I'd send it to Neil Gorsuch. I understand he's an even tempered and loves being corrected by podcast listeners. So.
Yeah. Well, didn't we learn with the slants, like it's impossible to get any of those facts corrected basically once you get to that point.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, exactly. But in the caption of the case itself, I would have thought that they would have referred to the university properly, but. Apparently not. Next up, our pal Harley tells us that the professions of data analyst and software engineer are very different. I totally agree. My wife is in IT, right? Yeah. Like I know that these are different professions. The point, and I think we've done the Google manifesto to death, so I want to pass very lightly over this. I did not mean to impugn either data analysts or software engineers, but I think we can all agree that neither of those positions are chief operating officer or chief diversity officer or are in any way related to the subject of the manifesto, which was only, you know, that's the sole point we were trying to make, that this was unsolicited on the job.
Ooh, I like this one. We finally got an answer on this one that I can't believe you didn't know when I asked you this.
I suspected this. So Scott Schlafly and a bunch of other people after our Q&A segment on Tuesday's episode chimed in to say that historically the bar was an actual wooden bar that separated where the lawyers sit from the gallery. That is still the case in most courtrooms today. There's a little swinging gate and you go through.
Oh, yeah,
and I was pretty certain that that was the origin, but we do these Q&A sessions entirely off the cuff.
Entirely drunk. And, it's off the cuff.
Yeah. And entirely without research. So, you know, it's part of the fun. We are doing a live Q&A. It's going to be our second Patreon video live Q&A this Friday at 7 p.m. So tonight, pretty
baby
much.
Baby Phoebe will be there.
Oh, little baby opening arguments. Yeah. I can't wait.
Opening arguments, Phoebe Smith. Mascot. And, hey, do we have an opening arguments onesie yet for toddlers? We got it for newborns and toddlers. I need a preemie size, probably. If you're gonna make that up,
I will get that made. Absolutely, right. I will get that made.
Even though she wasn't preemie, but anyway, go on.
So, yeah, I was pretty sure I knew the story, but I wasn't sure if it was apocryphal. I'm still not sure if it was apocryphal. Yeah. And, you know, rather than confidently say and have to do an Andrew was wrong, I'm doing an Andrew was wrong anyway. So perhaps I should have just gone with my gut, but I decided discretion was the better part of valor on that. A whole bunch of people corrected us or at least submitted what they thought was the correct answer, which sounds totally plausible to me. So thank you for your contributions. And first past the post was Scott Schlafly. So
there we go. Well, you haven't been wrong and about now we're anything done. That's, else.
Those are the only 18 things I've ever been wrong about ever. So until next week.
Good. We've left plenty of time for the meat and potatoes of this podcast. So let's move on to our main segment here. All right, Andrew, here we go. The trans military ban. This is why I don't know if you said this or we both said this or I said it, but a lot of people were saying, oh, don't worry about this. No one's actually doing anything about the trans ban. It hasn't gone into effect. And it's like, well, it could at any second. And sure enough, he signed it into effect. Is that right? Do I have that right?
Yeah. President Trump on August 25th, so 6 days ago, as of this recording, released a memorandum to the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Homeland Security, of which the subject is military service by transgender individuals. And what this does is, number one, it prevents the accession of military service members who are transgender. It means that the military is not hiring new individuals who are trans. With respect to existing service members who are trans, the policy directs the armed forces, the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Homeland Security to consider the best way to meet with the standards of Trump's desire not to have trans individuals serving openly in the military by 2018. Okay. So one of the, and I should add the final segment of this is 2B, which halts all use of DOD, Department of Defense, or Department of Homeland Security resources to fund sex reassignment surgical procedures for military personnel, except to the extent necessary to protect the health of an individual who has already begun a course of treatment to reassign his or her sex. Okay. So the Secretary of Defense is then supposed to consult with the Secretary of Homeland Security and provide a recommendation to the contrary that, quote, I find convincing, I meaning President Donald Trump, otherwise with respect to existing service by trans service members, or otherwise find a policy that will deal with the issues regarding some of these people we know, some of whom have been, you had one on Serious Inquiries Only.
Can we say that that's unconstitutionally vague? Because God only knows what is going to convince Donald J. Trump. There's
Who knows, right? And so the first thing that I want to talk about is there have been a number of reports that have gone about because, you know, Mattis has said, Secretary of Defense James Mattis has said, you know, we're not kicking everybody who's trans out of the military right now. We are going to study the issue. We are going to come up with recommendations. And the initial round of reporting on that said, you know, Mattis rebukes Trump. Yeah. Mattis refuses No, that's what he was directed to do by the scope of this order. Okay, so there was no defiance by the DOD or the DHS. The order. And again, you know, that you can think of Trump's legal team like, you know, the goldfish that they train to run mazes, right? Like they're not very bright, but after having banged their head against glass a bunch of times on the Executive Order 13780, the so-called Muslim ban, right? Like the first time they issued that executive order, they didn't take into account the distinction between people with pre-existing rights versus changing the policy going forward. It was immediately blocked and they had to reissue a new EO. So, you know, you sort of see the goldfish taking a slightly different path this way. and it is not surprising that that some distinctions have been made in this policy. That has not stopped various groups, including the ACLU of Maryland, in conjunction with my old friends at Covington and Burling, from filing a lawsuit seeking declaratory judgment in the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland, trying on behalf of trans service members, seeking to block the enforcement of this directive. I do want to get into that. I want to point out that CNB as a firm, Covington and Burling in Washington, D.C., is really, really split on this. A number of folks, people I know personally, people who were associates when I was an associate, Rob Kellner, Keith Noriega, and others, have gone into the Trump administration in a variety of capacities. So CNB has a lot of connections to Republican politics, and a lot of those folks have filled that out. CNB also does a lot of pro bono work, and they have connections to the ACLU. And so some of the more liberal partners have taken a different approach. And this is Carolyn Corwin, somebody I also know as a colleague, did a little bit of work for her, gosh, 20 years ago at this point. And so Covington and Burling has agreed to take on this case and do all of the, not all of the, but do a lot of the legal research in conjunction with the ACLU. So with that kind of background in mind, what are they alleging, and how do we evaluate it? As usual, I'm going to link the complaint in the show notes, and you know to skip to the end. You skip to the end, you see who's bringing this. Okay, it's the ACLU and Covington and Burling, one of the most prestigious law firms in the country. Okay, well, probably not going to be a nonsense complaint. And then let's go up and look at what the actual allegations are, and we scroll back to page 31, two counts in the complaint. Count number one is that this directive violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Fifth Amendment.
I expected that one.
Right. And the allegation is that it violates equal protection by ban on existing service members, which is going to take, which we've just discussed, takes effect in 2018. And it talks a little bit about the vagueness and says Section 3 requires the Secretary of Defense to determine by February 21, 2018, how to, quote, address currently serving transgender men and women. Although these service members are permitted to continue service until this determination is made, transgender service members are immediately impacted. They have grave reason to fear for their careers. They must reevaluate their career plans. They could suffer significant stress and psychological harm. And they serve in a military where the commander-in-chief has announced that their service is unwanted, unwelcome, and that their medical care will be withheld. So I agree with all of that, that even though the implementation is prospective, that they have alleged harm for existing trans service members. Mm. The ban on new enlistments is obviously negatively impacts individuals who are trans, who want to serve in the military. And then the ban on medically necessary care, the allegation is that transgender service members who require medically necessary care to treat gender dysphoria are entitled to care on an equal basis as to what is provided to non-transgender service members with medical conditions requiring comparable medically necessary care. Because as you recall, the ban says essentially if you're in the middle of gender reassignment surgery and it is necessary to your health, that those treatments will continue, but nothing else will.
Okay.
And so
like you said, they're that rat in a maze or whatever you just,
yep.
Goldfish in a maze. They're figuring it out.
So that's the harm. And then the question is, how is it a violation of equal protection and on what basis? And interestingly enough, the allegation is that that this should require heightened scrutiny because it is discrimination on the basis of sex. And this, I think, is raising an equivalent argument to the argument that we have discussed at some length within the Hively case and subsequent
decisions. It all comes back to Hively.
Yeah. And we know how the battle lines are going to break down on this, right? The government's response is going to say, we're not discriminating against trans individuals on the basis of sex. We're discriminating against them on the basis of their being trans.
Which Hively will come back and say, how in the world are you doing that without also discriminating on the basis of sex? I mean, it's like, how would they even do that? How would they even justify that? I don't understand it.
Yeah, and they would use the same argument that was raised in the dissent in Hively, which is to say
they're discriminating against trans men and trans women equally.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. As additional argument for the notion that discrimination against trans individuals should receive heightened scrutiny. They're the allegation that men and women who are transgender as a class have historically been subject to discrimination. They have a defining characteristic that bears no relation to an ability to perform.
You know what I just realized would really help in this situation? Some sort of bill that recognizes trans people as a protected class, like, you know, like Bill C-16 in Canada, something like that, that would be incredibly helpful and prevent a bunch of discrimination and give people recourse, trans people recourse on this stuff.
But if you were a law professor, you might not be able to use pronouns properly in class. So.
And the overlords will restrict all of our speech and it'll become a Marxist society or something. Yeah. That too. Anyway,
by the way, if you're not part of the Serious Inquiries Only and our Facebook and Twitter extended universe, that's a little bit of sarcasm right there. We've gone back and forth. There is a bill that passed in Canadian Parliament. It's Bill C-16. We've referred to it obliquely, that recognizes trans individuals as a protected class.
Yeah, that's all it does.
And has drawn the ire of academics.
Classical
like
liberals
Peterson,
everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who claim that it's so oppressive and unfair that, they might feel bad and somebody might tell them that they should have to use the pronoun that a transgender person wants to identify by instead of the pronoun that they think that person should use. Or, as we've pointed out since the very beginning, not using a pronoun at all. I struggle sometimes with particularly, we have a couple of friends who are non-binary and I struggle with the pronoun use sometimes. And you know what? Like, when I have difficulty with a pronoun, I just use that person's name. It's a really weird thing. Anyway.
But am I right to say that that would essentially solve this
absolutely.
Problem?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If we had a bill like C-16, that would cause this to clearly fall within heightened scrutiny instead of being something that is going to be argued in the courts.
Ugh.
Right? And all the rest of it. They're discreet, they're insular, they're a minority with relatively little political power. All of the classical reasons why you should invoke heightened scrutiny for discrimination against this group of people. But I should add, in terms of urging caution, I'm going to talk about a couple of cases in a minute, but it's not clear to me that the court is going to accept that discrimination against transgender individuals is discrimination on the basis of sex. And for the Hively reasons, right? Because the government is going to say, no, we're treating trans men and trans women equally. We hate them both. And that's precisely what, if we had legislative protection, would no longer be an issue. But we don't, so it is. So that is the equal protection argument. The second claim is a claim of the violation of substantive due process. And what that means is that the government, this is actually a strict scrutiny standard. The government must have compelling reason and it must be narrowly tailored in order to deprive you of rights which are, quote, implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. Okay. And here, the complaint alleges that service in the military, the right to medical care, and the right to rely on the opportunities, benefits, and privileges that are already established are parts of those fundamental rights. And I should tell you that there are no cases that stand for the proposition that those three things are core rights that are implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. The closest that I can find is Jehovah's Witnesses case that says the right to refuse medical treatment is a core right. And in other words, you cannot be subjected to medical treatment without your consent. And that's the closest hook I can find to the medical component, which is just one aspect, obviously, of this trans ban. It's going to be an uphill battle. Now, again, you would ask the question, is it a fundamental right to serve in the military? And here's where I'm going to go to a couple of cases that I think give us a real hurdle here. Okay. And the first is a case called Rosker versus Goldberg. It is a 1981 decision, and that decision upheld the fact that selective service only requires men to register for the draft. Okay, it was a declaratory judgment saying, look, like this is very clearly discrimination on the basis of sex. And yet the Supreme Court said, yeah, you know what? We are going to defer to the operation of the military in saying that they're only going to require men and not women to sign up for the draft. Now, again, does that provide... Right. Could you distinguish that? You can distinguish that case, right? Like, but if you have a fundamental right to serve in the military, this case and the subsequent decisions that I'm about to talk about that give extreme deference really cast doubt on that notion, right? Like, so for example, women were banned from the military for most of our nation's history, and then banned from combat, and the courts have upheld those kinds of determinations and discrimination on the basis of sex. And so if you were to imagine that there is a fundamental right to serve equally in the military, you would have expected the courts to come to the opposite conclusion. And so, and you may have noticed, I'm sort of blurring the lines between the equal protection and substantive due process. The reason for that, I think, is going to be clear in this next case, which is Parker versus Levy, which is a 1974 decision, 417 U.S. 733. And what happened in that case was Levy was an army doctor who was, while serving as an army doctor, told other soldiers under his command that Vietnam was a war that was taking a disproportionate number of black soldiers. Okay. And then he was court-martialed and sentenced to 3 years in prison.
Wow.
And the Supreme Court upheld the court-martial.
For what? What was the crime? I don't get it.
The crime was telling people that Vietnam is killing young black men, right?
Wow.
Yeah. He was court-martialed for, among other things, conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, and willfully disobeying a lawful command of a superior commissioned officer. That is, his superiors who were saying, hey, ixnay on telling the blacks that they're getting killed over there in Vietnam. And wow. So the Supreme Court not only upheld the court-martial and said, it doesn't matter that the military is infringing on your freedom of speech, right? Your basic core right here of free speech. The Supreme Court upheld the court-martial, said, doesn't matter that they are infringing, that the military is infringing on Dr. Levy's core free speech, that we're going to give extreme deference to the military in determining how the military should be run. Wow. And here's what the majority said. This was William Rehnquist at the time, was an associate justice, later be Supreme Court chief justice. He wrote, this court has long recognized that the military is, by necessity, a specialized society separate from civilian society. Okay. And so this notion that the military is separate and a very different kind of society has persisted in Supreme Court jurisprudence since 1974. So for the past 30 odd years. Such that here is kind of a brief survey of cases in which individuals have raised challenges that have been rejected by the courts. So we had United States versus O'Brien, 1968 decision, which affirmed the conviction for an individual who burned his draft card, right? That was a big popular thing back in the 60s. Greer versus Spock, 1976 case in which the court approved the removal of civilian protesters from a public road that ran through a military base. So again, people engaging in free speech, but the fact that the public road was running through a military base, military gets its own rules, you have less free speech. 1980, Brown versus Glines. The court rejected First Amendment claim of a soldier who wanted to collect signatures for a petition objecting to military grooming standards, wanted to be able to wear his hair longer. And the Supreme Court said, nope, no First Amendment right there. We already mentioned Roscoe versus Goldberg, male-only draft registration, equal protection claim by the male registrant. Solorio versus United States, 1987. UCMJ applies to all soldiers at all times. And Goldman versus Weinberger, 1986, court rejected a free exercise claim by an officer who wanted to wear a yarmulke while on duty. Okay, so all of those cases have relied upon the Parker versus Levy standard, which says they are military is a separate society and they get to play by their own rules. The only case I can find that gives some notion of hope here, in my view, is a case called Frontiero versus Richardson. It's a 1973 decision, so predates Parker versus Levy. That's part of how you're going to distinguish it. In that case, in Frontiero, there was a military policy that said provided automatic benefits to the wives of male soldiers, but not the same level of benefits to the husbands of female soldiers.
Huh.
Okay. And the Supreme Court reviewed that case under the intermediate scrutiny standard and found that what differentiates, and this is a quote from the case, what differentiates sex from such non-suspect statuses as intelligence or physical disability and aligns it with the recognized suspect criteria is that the sex characteristic frequently bears no relation to or ability to perform or contribute to society. As a result, statutory distinctions between the sexes often have the effect of invidiously relegating the entire class of females to inferior legal status without regard to the actual capabilities of its individual members. So the plaintiff in that case won and said that held that the military could not justify the discrimination for administrative convenience, which was the presumption that husbands of female soldiers were less dependent on their wives than wives of male soldiers, which you know, may or may not have been true in 1973.
Right.
Certainly is not the case today. So that benefits case is the only case I can find, and it predates the Parker versus Levy. So what I say here is that the ACLU has and my friends at Covington have a real uphill burden.
Yeah,
they really do. And you know, it goes back to what we have said since episode number one, right? There's a reason we began this show with a study of the election of 2000 and with our nonstop tagline that elections have consequences.
Yeah.
This is a consequence.
So we're trying to sum up basically what you're seeing in the case law. It's the military is essentially thought of as a separate animal than the general public. And so they're generally allowed to kind of do some things that wouldn't be allowed in general society.
Right. You've got two hurdles. So you have it's a separate society. And then even if you get past that, even if you apply ordinary standards of equal protection and substantive due process, they both have the weaknesses that I've described in going through those individual counts, right? So the Equal Protection Clause has the weakness that the government is going to respond that this is just subject to rational basis, that it is not discrimination on the basis of sex because they're treating transgender men and transgender women alike. And the Substantive Due Process Clause has the problem that none of the rights that are at issue here are clearly established in the case law as fundamental rights. So yeah, so you've got a two-step hurdle to clear. It's going to make it a challenge. It really is.
Oh boy. Well, sorry guys.
I should add parenthetically, there is an argument to be made that this policy does not even pass rational basis muster, right? Like that we could make that argument because it literally is just Donald Trump tweeting one day and saying in his policy, like, you must do this to the standards that I find acceptable. I could see a court biting on that, right? I could see a court saying like, this is rational basis doesn't mean a lot, but it ought to mean more than what appeals to Donald Trump. Trump at 4 a.m. But I don't want to say all hope is lost. I do not want to say that there are not meritorious arguments being raised here. I want to paint a realistic view of the legal landscape.
Yeah. All right. Well, elections have consequences. The podcast basically is what we've become. Yeah. But
that's our spinoff. That's our spinoff. Yeah.
Thanks for taking us through that.
This show only with more screaming.
Thanks for taking us through that, even though it's very depressing. But we'll keep an eye on it. And yeah, hopefully we'll just have to hope that that small chance you outlined becomes a reality, I guess. Down. 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 So, Andrew, the Arpaio pardon. Now, I covered a bit of why he's one of the worst people I've ever seen. He's an awful, Joe Arpaio is an awful human being. Did some really disgusting things. But having, I guess we're going to set that aside for a minute to talk about the legal ramifications of pardoning an awful person.
Well, I mean, people should
listen
to episode 72 of Serious Inquiries Only, and you go through the underlying case, what Arpaio was convicted of, and everybody should listen to that for the factual background.
Yeah, for like, I talked about, you know, 2% of all his crimes against humanity, and it took up the entire episode. So there are some, we see this all the time whenever there's big legal news. We see the viral articles or whatever. And first one I think that I've seen that people would want to get your opinion on is the pardon itself. Is it legal? Now, I took a stab at this one because I felt confident enough to say that pardon power is really broad and it's almost certainly legal. But what do you think? Is there more nuance there?
Yeah. So the article that got wide circulation was an op-ed. It was penned by Martin Reddish, and he is a professor of constitutional law at Northwestern Law School. And he wrote an article for the New York Times that was initially entitled, you know, "No, Donald Trump Cannot Pardon Joe Arpaio," or something like that, right? The New York Times then changed the headline to "A Pardon for Arpaio Would Put Trump in Uncharted Territory."
Yeah.
After there was some push, including by me, there was, and so you may see, I commented on this despite being on vacation on Twitter and Facebook. You know, you never really go on that much of a vacation. And so when the headline was sent my way of, you know, "No, Trump cannot pardon Joe Arpaio," I wrote back and said, "This is wrong." And so you might see that attached to the article that now bears the header, you know, "This would put Trump in uncharted territory." I agree that it puts him in uncharted territory, whatever that means. But when you look at the actual text of the article, it says, and I'm going to read, this is, I think, the critical sentence where the article is just wrong. So it says, "Many legal scholars argue that the only possible redress for improper use of the pardon power is impeachment, itself a politicized, drawn-out process. I agree with that, except I would change that from many to all. It is the view that I have. It's the view that we went through in really extensive detail on Opening Arguments episode number 90, where we were talking about Donald Trump using the power of the pardon to pardon himself, which again, certainly would be uncharted territory, but as far as we can tell, is within the pardoning power of the president. But then it goes on to say, "But there may be another route. If the pardon is challenged in court, we may discover that there are, in fact, limits to the president's pardon power after all." Okay. Hmm. So that was the point of this article, despite kind of the rephrasing of the headline, was to suggest that you could challenge Arpaio's pardon. It was written the day before the pardon was issued in court and get it overturned. And the argument is, because Arpaio's underlying crime was depriving citizens of their constitutional rights, in particular their Fifth Amendment rights, that the fact that the Fifth Amendment was subsequently amended to the Constitution should be read as an implicit limit on the pardoning power. And Professor Reddish says, "I admit that this is a novel theory. There's no Supreme Court decision, at least that I know of," and I would add, or that I know of, that deals specifically with the extent to which the president may employ his pardon power in this way. That's true, and that doesn't go far enough. As we went through on OA-90, the cases involving presidential pardons explicitly point out that the remedy for extensive pardoning power is the impeachment remedy. Yeah. That's what the framing of the Constitution is meant to do. And I would add, in my view, sort of the fatal defect with this idea, because the argument is the president uses his pardon to pardon somebody who violates your constitutional rights.
Right.
Therefore, the president has allowed somebody to violate your constitutional rights.
Well, but let me ask you this.
Yeah.
How many, so the president can only pardon for federal crimes, right?
Correct.
How many federal crimes, how many other federal crimes violate constitutional rights? Is this a unique crime that he's being pardoned for, do you think? Or are other things violations of constitutional rights in the past?
Yeah, I mean, there are some crimes that are not violations of constitutional rights. Like, for example, if you pardon somebody who has committed, you know, murder with, you know, with a prohibited firearm, right? You know, with a semi-automatic weapon that's on the federal banned list. You could be charged with a federal crime, but that doesn't necessarily implicate your constitutional rights. But
right.
You're correct that many federal crimes, the victims thereof have had their rights violated. That's one point. The broader point that I would make is, every time, if your rights are violated and the prosecutor declines to bring the case in the first place, right?
Hmm.
Like, that would fall under the same scenario. But nobody would say that you could, for example, go to the court and get a writ of mandamus compelling a prosecutor to bring charges against somebody. I mean, that would be immediately dismissed, because the definition of mandamus is that you have no discretion, and the definition of prosecutorial discretion is that you have discretion, right? So, you know, you couldn't force the government to bring a charge, and letting someone go and not bringing a charge have the exact same effect in this case, right? Like, which is to say, the person whose rights have been violated is sort of left without redress and recompense for that. And finally, I would add that, you know, you see the analogy starting to break down, even as I'm struggling to fit that into the language of the pardon. We don't think of criminal penalties typically as providing recompense to the victim. We think of them as providing either or both of deterrence to others from committing the same crime or retribution upon the wrongdoer. But our criminal justice system is really not set up to be compensatory in any way. So, you know, the idea that by allowing the president to allow a criminal to escape prosecution, you're failing to appropriately compensate or protect that person's victim is just, I think the analogy sounds good in text, but doesn't.
Let me try this out, because we didn't really cover this, but the crime is contempt of court, right? So it's not even as though there would be recompense for the victim. Like, the victim is the court, really. I mean, we are all thinking of the victims as being the people he's done a bunch of awful stuff to, but actually it's not really technically, right? Because the courts told him to stop racially profiling. He didn't. And so now the crime is like that he didn't listen to the court. That's the federal crime that he's charged with, right? Or am I wrong?
I just want to point out for our listeners that is like, you don't have access to my notes coming into the show. That's literally the next point on my notes.
Okay.
So yeah, no, word for word. That's fantastic. And I think it shows you should get another half point credit on the bar exam.
I don't need
no,
it.
No, that's exactly right. Like, all of these, I was trying to build the best possible case for Reddish's arguments, and, you know, sort of an even if you don't accept that, and ultimately that's where it collapses, is that even if you think our criminal justice system is compensatory to victims, and even if you think that failure to prosecute is something that ought to be a constraint on the pardoning power and all of that, the underlying crime here is contempt of court. And there have been, I found on a search at the federal and state level, at least a dozen pardons within this century for individuals for contempt charges.
Wow.
So it is very clear that this is just within the president's power to do so.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. And again, look, this is...
Elections
I don't want us to continue... Yeah, right. I mean, I don't want us to continue to say, like, the only remedy is impeachment. And the only remedy is impeachment. And the more that we come to grips with that, and the more that that becomes the focus of the 2018 midterm elections, I mean, the more that sort of puts us in a position towards getting this country
really
back on track.
Yeah, we really do need to rack up just a list of impeachable, keep track of this. And then 2018, when we're trying to take back control of Congress, note how many different things are impeachable offenses that the Republicans haven't held him accountable for. And hopefully we can rock the vote.
I agree. I mean, look, like, in my view, that is the battleground on which the 2018 election should be waged. And if polls are to be believed, right, that's by far a winning approach for Democrats, right? To say, hey, look, like, this isn't partisan. This isn't about getting our team back, right? This is about the only remedy that you have as a populace for a president who doesn't care what the law is to put in members of Congress who do care. And I care. And ask my opponent, right? Is he willing to vote for charges of impeachment against Donald Trump?
Ryan, can you put in some swelling election ad music under that? Do it.
There you
go. Keep going. Keep going. No, that was a killer political ad you were doing. And I care. We need people in Washington who are going to care about the rule of law. I just thought you were going on a really good rant. So I hope Brian put some underscoring under that.
So, yes, Trump has the power to pardon our life. Very clearly.
Now, what about this civil lawsuit stuff? And also, I one thing that I definitely left as a question for you when I was talking about this is it seems like from what I'm reading, there's two contempts of court. There's like federal and civil contempt of court. Or am I crazy in that? I thought I read that and I didn't really understand the difference.
Yeah, they are both brought in federal court. So they both fall.
Or sorry, I didn't mean federal. I meant criminal contempt of court and civil contempt of court. Are there two different contempts?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
There are two different contempt charges that are brought. Both fall within the pardon, and so both have been wiped out as a result of the pardon. The distinctions are sort of not worth going into. I mean, one of them has to do with how you appear back before the court, and the other has to do with his actual conduct.
Okay, but Trump has the power to pardon the civil contempt of court as well.
Yes. Yes.
So that's a federal crime?
It is.
Oh, okay.
Because it was issued by a federal court.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. Huh. So the single biggest question that I think we've gotten is, okay, I get it, Trump pardoned Arpaio, but this now means that he's absolutely guilty because pardon carries with it the implicit admission of guilt, and therefore you can now go get a civil judgment against him as a matter of res judicata, right? Like, you can't even dispute that, right? And I would urge a little bit of caution with respect to that in a couple of ways. Okay. So the first is, a pardon carries with it the implication of guilt. We've been very, very clear to use that word because that's the word that the Supreme Court used in Burdick versus United States, which was the last time that we discussed this. You might say to yourself, what's the difference between admission and implication? So let me give you a real world example of how that distinction plays out. In 1999, President Bill Clinton granted the first posthumous presidential pardon in U.S. history. And he pardoned Lieutenant Henry Flipper, who was the first African-American graduate out of West Point in the late 19th century. He was court-martialed in 1881 after these trumped-up charges. There was some missing money, but there was pretty strong corroborating testimony that Flipper himself had never taken the money, and that, he was investigating like what happened, whatever. The underlying offense doesn't matter. The point is, Flipper was a hero in the African-American community for a whole lot of reasons, not the least of which was being the first African-American graduate of West Point. And to sort of remove that stain, President Clinton asked his Department of Justice whether he could issue a posthumous pardon to a dead man, right? Hmm. And the memo that was authored cited to Burdick versus United States, right? Said, okay, hey, look, the one problem that we know that potentially comes into play here is when you pardon someone who's living, they can choose whether to accept the pardon or not. And it carries with it an implication of guilt. A dead person obviously can't accept anything.
Yeah, this is like the Mormons baptizing everyone after they're gone.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, but nevertheless, Clinton pardoned Flipper. There were no legal challenges brought to it. And the DOJ memo ultimately concluded that it was a constitutional use of the pardoning power. There have been subsequent posthumous pardons, including by President George W. Bush. Governors have issued posthumous pardons. So it appears to be part of the landscape. The significance there is, again, you can cast implications, right? You can say, okay, this person has some level of guilt associated with the crime, but we want to mitigate the penalty that is affiliated with it. In this case, the importance of the posthumous pardon was removing the court martial, right? As was to be able to say in the way that I did that, yes, you know, there was an acceptance of the facts and of the misconduct, but that this person didn't deserve to be court martialed from the military.
Okay.
And so what does that mean in the context of a future civil case? It means that accepting the pardon does not equate to he's now definitely civilly liable for, he has not accepted the full range of guilt. It carries that implication. And in future civil suits, the parties will be free to argue that that should have that effect. But I cannot find a single case, I looked pretty exhaustively, in which a pardon was used as evidence, and I use the phrase res judicata, that means as a settled thing, right? Like, okay. In other words, that you cannot dispute it, right? So Arpaio will be able to dispute the extent to which the pardon should carry the implication of guilt, the extent of that implication in any future civil suit. But it does have weight. So in other words, the answer to this question is it has weight. It will be admitted if there are civil suits against Joe Arpaio, and that will be decided in court, but it does not carry unrebuttable dispositive weight. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's weird. I totally remembered that wrong from when we originally covered it. I thought a pardon did mean you had to accept, and essentially if you accepted it, you were admitting guilt, but I guess
you have to accept, and it carries the implication of guilt. But that word is a clear distinction, and it comes up in these sort of corner cases of pardoning a dead person. And I would be shocked. I mean, maybe Arpaio has terrible lawyers. Nobody let him listen to the show. But that is certainly the argument I would make if I were defending Joe Arpaio. God help me.
I would not no longer do a podcast with you if you were defending Joe.
Yeah, believe me, I'm highly unlikely to be asked. I think there's but I would certainly raise that argument, right? Well, that's the argument that I would make, is I would say, yes, it has the implication, but it is not sufficient to be construed as guilt as a matter of law.
Yeah.
And that's where I would go. It will be really interesting. I mean, I predict, I mean, if you want to tee up
future
maybe
Andrew,
future
was, wrong
Andrew was wrong.
Yeah.
I predict that ultimately, if there are civil suits, that they will prevail against Arpaio. You will either settle them or they will go to a judgment.
Well,
against
as
it.
I covered, the county has paid tens of millions of dollars, if not more, in suits that he against him, because they have to settle because he does horrible stuff to people, and then the taxpayers. How did he get reelected 4 times? God. You know, and that's something it's just frustrating. Trump is horrible for pardoning him, but really, like, the voters who kept electing this guy with the things he was doing, like, gosh, I can't believe it. Yeah. But anyway, I'm also seeing stuff about, like, will the judge dismiss the verdict still? And could you clarify what's procedurally, I guess, what's going on there? Like, one of the headlines in Washington Post right now is, Arpaio has been pardoned, but will a judge dismiss the verdict against him? What does that mean?
Yeah. So what Arpaio is seeking is really unprecedented, and I don't think he'll be successful on this. He is seeking to have the convictions expunged, right? So think about that as sort of like the difference between a divorce and an annulment, right? A divorce is what the pardon gives you, right? Which is to say, you have been adjudicated guilty of this crime, and now because of the presidential pardon, you don't have to pay the penalty for it. Right? You don't have to go to prison. Arpaio is seeking to expunge the crime in the first place, to say, as a result of the pardon, I have never been guilty of this offense. And that is, again, unprecedented in pardon cases. And in my view, will not remotely be successful. I don't see there's any ability to take a pardon because of what we just talked about, right? Like, we can talk about how much imputation of guilt does it carry with it, but it doesn't carry the negative connotation, right? Like, typically when you have cases of expungement or when you have offenses by minors that are conditional, that are subject to probation, and then you complete the probation, and then the original conviction is expunged from the record, right? It's as if it never happened. This happened. And so there's a little bit of arcane procedure, but I think it's very, very clear that because it happened, it will remain on the record and he will not be successful in having that conviction expunged.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people are asking this. Does being pardoned mean you can't plead the fifth anymore? Because, you know, they always say, let's say you plead the fifth and you're preventing from having to, I guess, admit guilt or testify your own guilt. I'm probably getting the wording wrong. But when you're pardoned, does that kind of go away?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the Fifth Amendment protects you from being compelled to be a witness against yourself.
Right. Yeah, right? That's the wording.
And if there is no crime for which you can be punished, then, I mean, the way practically in which it works is you receive a subpoena. A subpoena requires you to testify in a court proceeding. You then go into that court proceeding, and if they want to ask you about something for which you would implicate yourself, you would then plead the Fifth Amendment and say, I can't be compelled to testify in such a way that would incriminate myself. And the court says, yep, that's right. And you step down. If there were no pending charges, then you have no basis by which to resist the subpoena. So yes, absolutely. The fact that Arpaio has been pardoned for this means that if there are collateral related cases, he can be issued a subpoena and can be compelled to testify on those matters and can be compelled to testify about his conduct in ways that ordinarily you would be immunized by the operation of the Fifth Amendment.
Oh, very interesting. It seems unlikely to be that big of a factor to me, but that's just my guess. How do you think this will be important? I mean, it sounds like it was a correct legal point and not fake news, which I'm relieved at, but do you think it'll
matter?
Yeah,
I don't think it's likely to be a big issue, but it is there. Yeah, and it's worth knowing. It is certainly worth knowing in the context of as we continue our dizzying journey up Yodel Mountain, that Trump's ability to pardon cronies may have a double-edged sword aspect in that they can then be compelled to testify about their criminal activities. And that testimony may then implicate the president or may implicate others. So it's worth knowing the larger premise that's at stake.
Very interesting. All right. Yeah. Well, I think that covers all the legal questions that we have that the public had for you, Andrew, on the Arpaio pardon for now. I guess we'll keep an eye on it if anything changes. But thanks for answering all those. And now it is time for our favorite segment of the week, and that is Top Patron Friday.
Oh, Hall of Fame Patron Friday. Before we get to our Hall of Fame patrons, we owe, I want to blame Patreon for this because we both did a sort when in our bank shows, we did a nice shout out to our earliest and longest standing patrons. And
did something get messed up?
Well, at RyanMJF on Twitter, somebody who's won a previous TTTBE, longstanding friend of ours, Ryan wrote in, even gave us a screenshot. You didn't have to send a screenshot. We believe you. And said, I've been there from the very beginning and you missed me on the shout out. And all I can say, Ryan, is we did the sort that Patreon let us do. I don't know why it skipped you, but you have been a year plus patron at this point. And we love you very much. And everybody should follow. It's at RYMJF on Twitter. If you're not following him already after TTTB, you should definitely be following him now. And we're sorry we missed you, man.
Yeah, geez. What an oversight. Andrew was wrong, everybody.
Patreon was wrong.
And our top Hall of Fame patrons are Heather Leverage, Sakashite Fukasumi, Eats Podcast for Breakfast, Kaylee Reiser, Violet Page Hall, Grand Duke Niall the Legormophile, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Torsten Peel of Debunkatron.com, Steve Sigmund, Greg Sullivan, C6 Sarah, Sammy, Time Magazine's 2006 Person of the Year, Roger Metcalf, Rhonda the Dork, Rebecca Smelzer, Dan Irizarry, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking, The Wayward Willis Podcast, Philip Stromberg, Try Secular Manslaughter, CampQuest.org, 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 Squick Thinger, Matthew Vernon, Congratulations, Thomas and Lydia. Oh, thank you so much. Malaika Chandler, Jesse Stutt is my favorite lawyer, Andrew is a close two. And Jaga, co-host of the Shifty Bastards Transformation Podcast, and Jeffrey Maynard. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, and thank you to Jim Grove, Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast, Ian and Allie, Hunter Ash, Geeker41, Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Stephen Boyd at DJ Empirical, Sharon Frankel, host of the delightful podcast Habeas Humor, Soggy Pants, Adam Lenda, Aaron Grady, Brandon Smith, Cosmos Vigilante, Frederick Alstromer, Michael, No Seriously, Granny Weatherwax Will Really Kick Your Ass, Rops, no idea what that means, Thomas McCormick, Zika Baby's favorite new podcast, Reasonable Risk, Mitchell, Jessica Wilson, Clear as Kushner, Eric Johnson, Democratic Socialism is Anti-Fascism, DSAUSA.org, and the NetSec Heathen. That is, I think, the longest use of the extended names
getting
on
political.
This. Carl Zippel, Conrad Michaels, and our top patron, Zabby. Thank you all so much.
Thank you guys very much.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for my favorite segment, co-favorite segment. Thomas nails this easy bar exam that I don't know why they even bother doing it. It's just pretty much just anybody who takes it passes, I'm guessing. But okay, let's keep doing it just for fun.
Yeah, well, you are on a 6-question winning streak, Thomas, and I feel like you should press your luck. Do you feel like you should press your luck?
What does that mean?
No whammies.
Yeah.
All right, Thomas, a foreign visitor was on trial for kidnapping a small child. The prosecutor stated that the visitor knew the child personally, which is why the child went with him, and that the perpetrator knew the child's parents had money. The prosecutor called a witness to testify that the perpetrator told the witness, "I am looking forward to visiting with this child and his parents. They have a wonderfully luxurious house that I will enjoy staying in." The defense objected to the proposed testimony. Will the court likely sustain the objection? Okay, and your choices are A, no, the statement is admissible to impeach the accused and establish that he is lying on cross if he takes the stand. B, no, the statement can come in as impeachment if the accused takes the stand and as a party admission to show the material facts of knowing the child and that the family had money. C, yes, the prejudice of the statement will outweigh its probative value. Or D, yes, the statement is irrelevant to the issue of guilt or innocence.
Okay, well, this is the first one I've had to attempt after having a newborn and being pretty sleep deprived. So could be the streak coming to an end. I'm finding this one really confusing. I wonder if I'm just missing something obvious. So we'll see. But I don't know why it wouldn't be admissible. Like, it seems pretty... I don't know. Like, I can't, there must be some legal issue that there must be some legal thing at stake where it's like, no, this normally isn't, because it doesn't really seem, it doesn't mention hearsay. There's no mention of hearsay. There's no, it talks, the answers, if I'm trying to do some issue spotting, are talking about impeachment, which we have covered in a question, but not enough for me to know what the extended rules of when and it is and isn't okay. But I'm going to go with my gut that it is admissible. And so let's see, we've got, I'm going to eliminate A, no, the statement is admissible to impeach the accused and establish he is lying on cross if he takes the stand. Well, yeah, I'm eliminating that one because I think that B is more specific and seems more right, but I don't know that A is necessarily wrong. I'm also going to eliminate D, yes, the statement is irrelevant to the issue of guilt or innocence, because I really feel like you would want to establish that the person knew the child. That doesn't seem, it seems like a reasonable thing to establish. So I feel like I'm missing something in this question, Andrew. So this could be a total failure, but I'm going to go with B. No, the statement can come in as impeachment if the accused takes the stand and as a party admission to show the material facts of knowing the child and that the family had money. I don't know. I'm not. I feel no confidence about this answer, but I'm going with B.
All right. And as always, if you'd like to play along with Thomas on TTTBE, take our announcement tweet or post on Facebook and quote it, retweet it, send it back out, hashtag TTTBE, give us your answer, give us your explanation, therefore, and we will pick the best winner and read that person on Tuesday and shower them with never-ending fame and fortune, as all of our previous winners can attest.
Maybe I'm trying to throw everybody off because I'm such a pro at the test now and I absolutely know the answer. Or do I? I don't know. That's the game. You got to play it.
Are you going to? This is like walking through the casino. You see the roulette wheel has come up red six times in a row. Are you going to put your chips on red?
How dare you, sir?
You're putting them on black?
I'm a roulette wheel. That's the equivalent. Okay, fine. Andrew's saying it's absolute luck that I've gotten the six in a row. He's probably right. All right. Well, thanks for playing. Thanks for listening, everybody. Another great Friday podcast. Stuff full of things that I wanted to know anyway, which is, you know, that's why I do it. just to listen to Andrew. Thanks for listening.
That's why I do the show.
And by the way, catch us on the live Q&A. I know Andrew already mentioned it, but that's today, if you're hearing this on time, Friday, September 1st at 7 Eastern.
Yeah, 7 p.m.
At 7 p.m. Eastern time, or for real people like me, that's 4 p.m. It's the opposite of two. 7 p.m. Eastern time. That'll be a live Q&A for patrons only. It's really fun. I'm going to get Baby Phoebe on screen if anyone is interested in that sort of thing. But otherwise, it'll be a full, at least an hour of questions, interacting with patrons. We had an absolute blast last time, so don't miss it. It's a good reason to pledge over on patreon.com/law. Check it out. And we'll have to see you guys next week.
Bye.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.